All right, Project, welcome to the very first Throwback Thursday. If you're joining us as a long-time listener, medium-term listener, or a first-time listener, basically we decided that there are so many great interviews that we've done in the podcast in the past. You know, we're approaching number 300, and we almost did pretty much all interviews. I think maybe there was 1 or 2 weeks in the beginning, in the first 100, where it was just the two of us. And like, there's just some great stuff in there from, you know, from the first 100 to the second 100, and now getting into this third 100, there are just so many great timeless pieces of, you know, just banter and laughter and knowledge, which is just never goes away. And we wanted to bring some of it back. We wanted to refresh you guys on some of the best episodes ever had. So what you're getting now is kind of our pick in our head of what we've really enjoyed, and also based off your feedback and how the episodes went at the time of release. And so we're bringing some of the best episodes of all time back on this Thursday time slot. So that's what you can look forward to in the future, the Throwback Thursday. So what we thought as well as a little bonus, just to keep you guys kind of interested in the start of the show, is we give you kind of what's happened since then, like our relationship with this person, kind of the behind the scenes stuff that's happened. What's coming next for the relationship here, or if we'll ever get them back on, and just, yeah, really kind of shoot the shit just for, you know, 5 minutes, just to kind of update you guys on maybe some behind the scenes stuff you weren't aware of. So the guest today we have on is Brett Contreras. Now, he's known as the glute guy. We knew him, you know, a long time before we did the actual show with him. And, you know, I was really, really pleased with how he enjoyed the episode. He even said to us at the end of the episode, we hung on the call for a while, and he was like, I don't know what it was about this interview, or it's just, I don't know, the Australian accents or whatever, but like, I really enjoyed this. He's like, you know, I don't always do this, but I'm going to shoot it out to my mailing list. I'm going to speak to my clients about it. I'm going to share it on Instagram, all this sort of stuff. So we were really, like, I was really taken back. Like, I was genuinely surprised, like, wow, we did a really good job with like a really influential person in the industry, someone that we respect so much. So it's cool when you get that reciprocation, when they go, hey, you know, I do this podcast all the time, and like, this stands out to me. It just shows like the little bit of research that you do beforehand, and just kind of how we want the conversation to flow. I guess all the practice that we've had over time just pays off. It pays off. It was good fun.
And it was a really good episode. Like, he was talking about some stuff that I've only ever heard of, even since then, only talk about on this show.
Yeah.
Particularly his views on girls getting into like aesthetic competitions.
Yeah.
And the after effects of that. Like, I've never heard him talk about it again. So it was really, really interesting.
Yeah, that's what stood out for me. I mean, it's been over a year since we released this podcast. It's that really sticks out with me, is his kind of really brutally honest take on whether or not the industry should have like figure competitions and stepping on stage as like a sport of, you know, of the health industry.
And it's not from someone who's like profiting off like telling people not to. Like, it's the reverse. Like, if anyone was going to be like, hey, it's a really good idea to do this stuff, it's like him.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because he gets the best in the world.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Even bigger asses for on stage.
Yeah.
So like, his incentives are not lined up to be honest about it in any way.
Yeah.
But still he was.
Yeah, which makes him so genuine, which is why I appreciate what he says so much. This episode is like, yeah, it's really good. What's awesome about it, what's happened since then, guys, is Brett is coming back on the show. So we've recorded a second show with him. It's even better than this one. We're able to ask even more follow-up questions, and there's like new research coming out on volume and hypertrophy and training programs and other hip training that he started to do. And he had like, when you listen to this podcast, the Glute Lab, he's like planning to open more. So awesome episode. That's going to be out in September, I believe. So hang out for that episode. And he's releasing a book as well. But you'll hear all about that in a couple months from now. But for now, guys, enjoy the first Throwback Thursday of the My Muscle Project with Brett Contreras. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Friedman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
the Mind Muscle Project. All right, cool. So, Mind Muscle Project. Today we are joined by Brett Contreras. And he, for many of you who are listening that may not be familiar with his name, he's sometimes referred to as the glute guy. But that's not necessarily what I want to talk about specifically today, but I'm sure we'll come into it at some point. But Brett is a scientist. He's a man who's studied his PhD and is a regular reader of journals, and now multiple gym owner, which we can get into as well, which is always cool. But we're just excited in general just to have Brett on the show. So Brett, thanks for coming on and joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I did have an opening question that was to do with obviously the
the science and the PhD that you studied. There's this book that's been circulating around for a long time, and it just made me think of it because I've read it. And I don't know if you've read it as well, but it's called Bad Science. Have you heard of that book?
Never.
Okay.
No, never heard of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I was listening to you on this podcast describe the ways that people can become more scientific, and I think it's a really important way or important mindset to have when sort of interpreting your own training or nutrition or really just interpreting any information that you see on the internet. And that's sort of what that book goes into, Bad Science. It goes into different ways that people can understand how studies are flawed and how conclusions might not be correct or, you know, correlation, causation, that sort of thing. So I was wondering if you had like maybe a big two or three things that people should really focus on when they're interpreting what's out there on the internet in the information age to not get roped into doing stuff like ketogenic diets and, I don't know, high-intensity training, F45, that sort of thing.
Yep, I see this as being the most important question, like being, it's such an important thing and it's so hard to teach people. That's why when I meet someone and I can tell they're scientific, it's like, oh, good, like we share a similar language. We're going to think different things, but we share a common ground as far in terms of like how you evaluate evidence and how you make decisions. So I will tell you that I get very frustrated because I've been personal training for like 21 years now. You know, I've probably trained 2,000 people in my life. I've owned gyms. I've trained myself. I've tried everything out there. I also read research. I've also published like, I don't know, 45 studies or something like this. And, or been an author on 45 studies and obtained a PhD. And knowledge just doesn't come from just one area. It's you want to master your craft. You want to become the best you can be. You have to submerge yourself. And I look at these millennials. I look at these up-and-comers, and I'm like, they have no clue how hard you have to work. Mm. Like, I work a 12-hour day, then I go home and become the world's glute expert on my free time. I don't have hobbies like they. I don't watch sports. You know, like I don't play video games. I don't go to bars. I don't drink anymore. I don't have vices. I work and I love it and I love my field. But this is what it takes to become an expert. You have to pay your bills. You have to, you know, but it's not just about being an expert. If you want to be influential, you got to get out there. You got to be active on social media. So you got to be working long hours and you have to enjoy it or else you can't sustain it. But I'm going off on tangents right now. If you want to be master your craft, you can't just learn it through training people in the gym. There's only so much knowledge you can gain on your own. You've got to be seeking, you know, reading. You got to be trying to understand the science, and we'll talk in a minute about how to go about that. But also you cannot master strength and conditioning through reading journal articles. And so I see both camps make the stupidest claims. I hear coaches say stupid things, and I hear researchers say stupid things. And it's just common sense. If you wanted to be the best you can be, you'd spend time each day doing both. Let me give you an example. When I lived in Auckland, New Zealand, for the first year of my PhD, I met Nick Gill. He's the strength coach for the All Blacks rugby team. Mm. Now, he has his PhD. He is involved in the research. He's involved in research that's informative, that, you know, is going to potentially change the way they train their athletes. And he also is in the gym training people, and he works out himself. And that's my idea of how a true professional, how a true coach trying to master their craft should be. And it's just so common sense. Like, of course, if you want to be the best you can, if you want to be the best coach in the world, if you want to help change methods, if you want to, then you've got to be experimenting and publishing them and putting them out to the masses. And so that's why, you know, the All Blacks are the best team in the rugby team in the world. They're a small country of like 4 million people, I think. And they beat the rest of the world. A lot of that's their culture, but I remember my professor, John Cronin, telling me, Brett, in the U.S., you rely on population. You guys have the talent. we have to take the science more seriously because we don't have the population. So I can't tell you, when you're just a coach that doesn't understand science, you don't know enough about science to understand how it can help you. And on the flip side, when you are a scientist, you don't know enough to know how much you learn in the field working with people. You can't possibly understand it. And so you have to learn through a variety of ways. And the way I see science, it's like science is the truth. It's like how stuff really works. And we study it, but it's like how things really work and how they exist. And then we're flawed as humans. We try to understand science and we get data and we try to conduct good experiments and we're inevitably going to screw it up because of our biases and our methodological errors, but it's the attempt to the pursuit of continuing this knowledge base. And that knowledge doesn't just come from published studies. It comes from anecdotes. It comes from everything. And I hear these coaches make these bold claims and it's like, oh my God, I can just run down the list in my head of clients. And it's like, okay, that would work for this person, this person, this person. That would not work for this person. No good coach would ever say stupid things like that. Just like I hear coaches making claims and it's like, you would never say that if you had a scientific clue. So both sides need to work together. And and it's all just insecurity. The coaches are insecure about their scientific knowledge, so they undervalue science. And then the scientists are insecure that they don't have the experience in the field, and they undervalue it. And everyone knows that to be the best you can be, you got to be doing a little bit of both. So you got to be in the gym a large portion of the day, and then you got to hit the books just as hard as you hit the gym training yourself and training others. So I see knowledge, you know, your knowledge comes like a pie chart in three main ways. 1/3 comes from the experience you gain training yourself, experimenting with all the exercise, experimenting with different programs. 1/3 comes from training other people and working with people from all walks of life, ages, genders, fitness levels, anthropometry and anatomy and sizes and shapes. And then 1/3 comes from reading, from science, from reading and experimenting and attending lectures and talking to other coaches and watching YouTube videos and reading blog posts and all the way you learn from other people. And that's how you maximize your understanding. But as far as bad science, we are in a never-ending quest. It'll never end. I mean, think of the term snake oil salesman. This has been going on forever. With health and fitness, it's so easy to sucker people because you can create a logical rationale for everything that makes sense. I mean, I could tell you right now, you could say, Brett, just make up a way that sounds physiologically plausible where you can get rid of cellulite, you know, and I could just, if I had no morals, I could just be like, here is how you get rid of cellulite and just make it sound good. And the women would eat it up because they want to believe it. It's depressing to think, you know, yeah, I can improve upon it. Yeah, I can get in better shape, lose fat, build muscle, get a tan, use certain lotions. You can improve upon it, but there's only so much you can do. It's depressing to think that you want to believe in these things. You want to believe there's something you can do about it. And you want to believe that there's something that's easier than actually busting your butt for 3 years in the gym.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah, it was the... So how do you, like, obviously because you got the, you had your PhD, and I think from now, from memory, it's like been about 9 or 10 years since you finished it?
I think it was like 2000, maybe like 2015. It's only been like 3 years.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking like how you could do a PhD on like just glutes before, or what it would be like to do it before the rise of Instagram and now like post massive rise of Instagram. Because it's interesting, because like obviously you're a scientist, so you're getting into it to understand, you know, the level of science and anatomy that's behind, you know, glutes and everything that's involved with that muscle and that area and that sort of thing, and, you know, the hypertrophy science and all that stuff. But now it's like so important that people have like a huge ask to sell their shit programs They're like, you're now like so popular, but maybe not for a reason that you necessarily thought you'd be popular for, you know, or you'd have an audience that maybe you didn't necessarily think it would be your audience when you were studying at the time. Has that sort of been the case?
Kind of. So let me backtrack a bit. I was just a normal, like, you know, I was a teacher. I was a high school math teacher. And I had, it had been troubling me. Like, first of all, I want to make more money because I was a teacher in Arizona where it's like really low pay. Right. I was making 36 grand a year after 6 years of teaching experience and a master's degree plus 24 extra credits. Fuck. And I'm like, this is not, I can't, you know, I can't sustain a good living. I don't want, this sounds shallow, but I'm like, I don't want to meet an amazing woman and have her break up with me because I don't make enough money,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I want to live a better life, but I always want to be educating people, but I can do that as, you know, in a lot of different ways. So I always wanted to open up a gym. So I decided to pull the trigger. And right before I opened, you know, several months before I opened, that's when I thought up the hip thrust exercise. And I actually invented a machine called the Scorcher that lets you perform that exercise. We never did it off of a bench the way you see people do it now. It took me like 2 years to think of that. But it was, we always did it elevate feet and shoulder elevated so you'd sink your hips way down and get more range of motion. So when I thought of that, I'm not religious. I'm not spiritual. But I walked out into the, I remember it like it's yesterday. I walked out into my front yard and I looked into the sky and I went, oh my God, from this point forward, my whole life is going to change. And it was so weird. I knew it. I remember I have a twin brother. I called him up and I'm like, Joel, everything's going to change now. Like, I thought of this idea. And he's like, dude, quit being stupid. Like, quit being an idiot. And I'm like, seriously? And he's like, you're being really stupid right now. And I'm like, no, listen to me. And anyway, it's funny. But that's what happened. My whole life changed. And so the reason I wanted to get a PhD was because I was writing about the hip thrust, trying to get the hip thrust popular, and people would ask me complicated questions. And I hate not knowing the answer.
Mm.
I hate not knowing, you know, being able to answer people. So I just, you know, back then I wasn't like as nearly as good of a scientist. So back then it was, my answers were just trying to convince people. I wasn't trying to be right so much. I was trying to, you know, I cared more about appearing right than being right. Now I'm a better scientist. So it's like, let's see what the data says, you know. And so the reason I wanted to get my PhD was not to become a research professor. I never wanted to do that. It's just, I genuinely wanted to understand the differences between squats and hip thrusts and different glute exercises and understand them to the greatest degree possible. And that's what I did. And so the knowledge there was, I didn't foresee the boom of Instagram coming. But what's nice is that all these Instagrammers now, they all follow me. All the girls with the best butts, they all follow me so I can at least help them create better programs and better systems to where they're not such crummy programs as you alluded to.
Mm. And you know, you mentioned all the research. Something I notice a lot is people will like recommend these days because you can access the research. They'll say, oh, you know, just go look at the research yourself, like take some ownership over it, like it's all on PubMed. But, you know, I didn't go to university for anything to do with health and fitness. And I just have a feeling that I can go and I can read it, but I don't really understand it in a way that I should. And like, I don't know the context of it. And you know, if I went to law school and if I could say, hey, go read like the case decision, they could read it and be like, yeah, I got it. And they have no idea about the context and like, oh, this was in a different state. And anyway, and I just think that, like, do you think with the recommendation to go read the research, you actually have to have training behind it? And for someone like me, I'm better off choosing my experts and just going with what they say.
God, this is such a good question. It's so funny you say that because my old intern, Andrew Vygotsky, he interned for me years ago, and now he's much smarter than me. I told him back then, I said, I'm going to be able to influence your life very much this year just because I got you when you're 21. In a few years, you'll be way smarter than me. I'm a teacher. I know talent. This guy's a genius. He's a mathematical genius, calculus, physics, biomechanics. And I love it because through him, I'm able to publish a lot more cool stuff because I am not capable of I don't know musculoskeletal modeling like he does. And we have amazing conversations, though. And I like the yin and the yang between my practical experience and then his techno expertise. But sometimes he'll send me a study and I'm like, I don't know what this is saying. I have my PhD. I can't. They have these 3D graphs where there's three axes, and my brain can't get the 3D graphs. And he laughs at me because he gets it. He can interpret them. And I'm like, he always sends me those when he comes across them. He's like, here's your favorite type of graph. And I'm like, why do they do this? Who can understand this? But anyway, I think it's important that, you know, I have my PhD, though. I'm not that good at stats, which is funny. I'm a math teacher, but stats and like accounting, I'm not very good at. I'm good at algebra and geometry. And you can't be, you know, you know what my best skill as a researcher is reading the methods with training studies, with long-term training studies, because I've been a trainer for so many years. But there are studies I read that I'm like, I think I understand what they're saying. I may or may not know the statistical procedure they used. I may not really understand their language. Some of these researchers write to impress fellow researchers instead of, and that's where I feel like the only value I bring to the table when I publish studies with like my colleagues, Brad Schoenfeld and Andrew and Chris Beardsley and these guys, is that I can read through, especially the abstract, and make it more coach friendly, more personal trainer friendly, because ultimately you want your research affecting the masses. Mm. And sometimes they write these abstracts and I'm like, this is so stupid. Like, I'm a blogger. Let's make it as simple as possible and tell them what they need to hear. Now I'm rambling again. To answer your question, I'm so glad you admitted that. I think the fact that you went to law school, you're comfortable enough, you're secure enough with your intelligence to understand. I don't quite understand that study, and I suspect that 90% of people don't know what they read. They just read the last sentence, the conclusion on PubMed, and draw base their conclusion on that instead of actually looking at the methods, looking at the limitations, reading the full paper. And this happened the other day. I had a guy write an article, and he's like, you know, can you look over it? And I'm like, well, you didn't mention this, this, or this. And he's like, oh, man, I guess that's why you need to read more than the abstract. I'm like, you just wrote a full article and you didn't get the full paper? Like, you have to read the full paper and see. It was the German volume training study, and it showed that 5 sets of 10 was actually better than 10 sets of 10. But there were some things about the study that you need to know a little bit more of. Because I went through it and I'm like, okay, this is good. It shows that there's an upper limit to volume. But if you read the study carefully, you would see that they gave everyone 2 warm-up sets that were still challenging. So it's really like the one group did 7 sets and the other group did 12 sets. You'd also see that some of the days they gave people 2 exercises for that muscle group. When, like, Charles Poliquin in the original pioneers of GVT said you pick 1 exercise, not 2. And the third thing you'd notice is that the upper body exercise were all 60% of 1 rep max for 10 sets of 10. But the lower body, they did leg press and lunges on the same day and used like 70% of 1 rep max, I think, for both of them. And it might have been 80% for the leg press. And I'm going, I've leg pressed 1,000 pounds. For 2 reps. Like, so my 1 rep max is probably like 1,050. If you had me do 80% of RM, it would be like 850 for 10 by 10. With like, I think it was 1 minute rest or 90 seconds rest. There's no way in hell I could do it. So the when they said like all subjects were able to perform, no, they weren't. No, they were not. You're lying. You're lying, or something's off, because that can't happen. That cannot happen. Why did they use those different loads? The peer reviewers didn't make them change that. They didn't make them give a reason. Why did you choose different loads for the lower body? Something needs explanation there. Maybe they were ultra strict with their 1 rep max, and I don't know. Mm-hmm. That needs more explanation. But this guy who wrote an article on it didn't point any of that stuff out. He just went by what he read in the abstract. So you have to be trained in this stuff. You have to know what you're doing, and you've got to, and it takes time. So think about how long it took you to become good at reading legalese and learning law, Australian law or whatever. It takes a long time. The average person can't just do it. The average gym rat can't do it either. just reading PubMed, but you got to get started somewhere. I had to do the same thing, you know, 15 years back when I started too. I remember pulling up, you know, because on Google sometimes you can get the full paper, and sometimes places have uploaded the full paper, or it's an open access and you can get the whole article. And you just try to glean as much as you can. And then over time you get way better at it, especially if you receive some training. But your question now is, should you try and read it yourself or just listen to experts, get a few trusted guys? The answer is both. So for me, I'm an expert in like strength and conditioning, glutes, biomechanics, but I'm pretty confident with my understanding of nutrition and you know, how to prep people for competitions and fat loss and things like that. But I will never be as smart as my friends Alan Aragon, Brad Schoenfeld, James Krieger. Those are the guys I go to when I have questions. But I've heard them talk, I've heard them speak so many times that I kind of know the answer to things, but I have not formed my own conclusions through reading all the studies like they have. That's ideal scenarios. Mm. You've spent so much time in that field, you know the research, you read it yourself, and you formed your own conclusions based on that, because people always form different conclusions based on the evidence. It's like the three of us are exposed to a certain topic, and here's all the evidence possible. We'll all have different interpretations and slightly different spins on things. And you mentioned ketogenic earlier in the podcast. I just met a trainer who was like, it's so hard being a scientist, because this guy was jacked. He's 6'4" or 6'5". And I'm 6'4". I don't know what that is in centimeters, but we're both tall dudes and big dudes. And I went into the gym and he gives me the nod. I thought it was just a big guy nod, but apparently he knew who I was. And he starts telling me how he's keto and how everything we've been told is a lie and everyone should be doing keto. And I'm like, this is my buddy Alan Aragon. This is a favorite topic of his. I've seen all the research. I've seen him slaughter guys. He debated a guy at the NSCA personal trainer conference, and he just can pick these dudes apart. He knows the research. So I'm just kind of cringing inside, but it's like, do I really want to get into this with him? So I was just like kind of nodding, oh, cool, yeah. And so because it works for him, he's going to give everyone a keto diet. All of his clients will be put on keto.
Yeah.
And there are situations where you should put someone on keto where that would be the best situation for them, but not everyone. And this is why you need to work with a wide variety of people, read a variety of research, not just cherry pick the keto studies showing, you know, positive adaptations. You got to expose yourself to all the research and have a lot of experience working with a wide variety of people to put it in proper context. You know, where does this best fit and when does it best apply?
Mm. Yeah, no, that's good. That was a good answer to that. It's funny, I was thinking about my first German volume training session, because it's pretty much any gym goer, just that's kind of what they start with.
It's the rite of passage.
And it was the funny thing about my weight training experience was, I was one of those guys who, like you said before, you said you never wanted to not know the answer to something. So I reckon I became like this bookworm expert before ever lifting a weight or stepping into the gym. And it was the same with like CrossFit. I researched so much on it before I ever went to an affiliate. So I like knew everything, and I had like the best program written up before I'd ever lifted a weight in my life. I'm like, it's 10x10 squats, like 100%. It's how you get jacked. And I did the 10x10 squats. I was like 16 or something. I remember the gym that we went at, it's like after school program. And so you go with like a group of mates that didn't get into the sporting teams, and you go like the local PCYC gym. I was in there and I did the 10x10, and fuck, it was light. It was like 40 kilos. It was like the green plates. So yeah, it's the 40 kilos. And it wasn't far from my house, so I reckon it was probably maybe like 15-minute walk home. And it was mostly like kind of flat, a little bit of downhill. And I did the 10x10 squats, and then in between, my legs started shaking, like uncontrollably shaking. I remember having to sit down because my legs started shaking at like set 8, set 9. And then when I'd finished and I cooled down, I was trying to walk home. When I got to the slight decline on the way home, I couldn't walk. Couldn't go down. I couldn't put any tension on my quads. So I had to call my mom. I was sitting on the side of the road. I go, hey, mom, I've done something really bad. I can't walk. Can you come pick me up? She goes, I'll be there in an hour and a half. At this point, I was like 5-minute walk from home. I could have crawled home in an hour and a half. And I waited on the sidewalk because I couldn't stand up. Hour and a half. And then like Dom's like insane. You know when your legs are so sore you can roll them out on the floor?
Yeah, yeah. Just any touching is massage.
Yeah, you just lie on the floor and just roll them out. That's essentially the stage I got to. So that was my German volume training story. I do have a question though. I was reading
That was just such a good story though, because my friend Ben Bruno and I often talk. He's a celebrity trainer in Hollywood, but we always talk about how stupid we were, you know, in our early days of training, but we were all stupid. That's how you learn. You have to, you know, all of us overtrained or overreached or whatever the hell you want to call it. We did such crazy stuff, but hell, that's how you got smarter.
Mm. Yeah, it's always funny to reflect on. And no matter how much you tell people when you see them in person, like, trust me, I've been there. Like, yeah, you don't want to do this. They still go and do it. It's like, oh, that's cool. He's got to make his own mistakes. Like, that's just how it goes.
That's what I tell all my clients. You're going to round your back on deadlifts. You'll get away with it for a while. You're going to have crappy form. You're going to say, oh, those guys get injured. I don't. I'm bulletproof. I'm invincible. So and then you're going to hurt yourself, and then you're going to still go back to it. And after you hurt yourself severely, like three times, then you start to widen up.
After you're lying in
that
hospital.
That is spot on, yeah.
Yeah, it's very accurate. But I did. I actually had a question about new research. I read something yesterday from Joel Jameson. I don't know if you know him. He's a bit of a science student, 8 weeks out. And he had something where he was citing a new study about rats or mice or something, where they made them walk a certain amount, and what they sort of noticed over is that basically what the study found was the metabolism, your body's metabolism has like a set amount of output every day. Like, most people think that they can eventually work up to a point where they're burning, you know, so much energy, you know if you run a marathon, or if you have, you know, instead of 10,000 steps you do 20,000 steps, you're going to burn this much more energy. And he says it's not actually true. There's kind of like an upper limit. You were saying before, there's like an upper limit to volume. Well, it's the same kind of thing that this study showed with the metabolism in the rats, is that the metabolism has an upper limit of output. And what ends up happening is that, like, beyond a certain point, you can't actually burn more energy. What's happening is the body is just diverting how it's spending its energy, and it's like down-regulating massively on certain things. So if you like started going up to like 25,000, 30,000 steps with some of these rats, like, the other functions in their body, the other vital functions or non-vital functions, would downregulate massively, so that the metabolism could keep them walking, but not, you know, surpass its upper limit. And so, like, say whatever the upper limit is, 10,000 calories, for example, you know, that it can't, you know, put out more energy than that in a day. The rat would just, you know, sacrifice certain things to maintain a certain level of activity. And I guess that's what you hear sometimes, is like crazy marathon stories, like people's bodies shutting down. It's like their metabolism hitting that top end, and it's just like, that's enough. And it's like shutting them down, or like they start pissing themselves because they can't, like, those urinary muscles just start giving out. That
so you can't just eat more if you've like, once you've burned a certain amount. Is that right? Like, if you kept burning and then you ate as much as you burned, you would gain weight because you're down regulating the rest of the day.
Potentially. I'm not sure how the nutrition part comes into it.
So there's, like, on a not as severe level, there's this classic study by Bouchard. And I wrote an article like in 2010 called The Truth About Bodybuilding Genetics. And so it's been a lot of years since I read this study. It's been 8 years. But there's this classic study by Bouchard. He's like an amazing researcher, Bouchard, on fat loss, like the kind of like genetics behind fat loss and things like that. And he had this classic study where they overfed people 10,000 calories a day for 84 out of 100 days. Basically, they'd overfeed like Monday through Friday for like 10 straight weeks or something, or whatever, 84 out of 100 days. So theoretically, if you're getting 1,000 extra calories a day for 84 out of 100 days, you should have gained, like, I don't know what it came to, like, say 30 pounds or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so one guy, the most, and then it was so cool, they broke it down into, like, they discussed the individual responses. And one guy actually just gained, like, all 30 pounds. And then they looked at where he gained it, and it was almost all in the midsection. He gained so much central adiposity. This guy was probably after the study going, why in the...
That's got the worst deal.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Now I'm screwed for life. I'm never going to lose this belly. So he had, like, the worst genetics, and he gained all the weight, and he stored most of it in his belly. And then the best responder only put on, say, like 12 pounds or something like that. And the reason why is because of NEAT. Well, some people call it NEPA, but it's your fidgeting. You have a body set point, a body weight set point, and a body fat set point that you kind of like to. Some people are very efficient at this. They would eat more, and then you just fidget more. And you can have, like, if you have studies that are done in a ward, you can have cameras on these people, and you'll see they're, like, fidgeting, they're pacing back and forth, they're up, they're just so much more active. And this guy, because of his fidgeting and pacing, he ends up burning a lot of it off and only gaining, like, I don't know if it was 12 pounds or 7 pounds, and none of it was central adiposity. It might have been a lot of muscle mass that he gained or just fat over the rest of it. He probably looked better. Like, he would have been like, oh, cool. It turns out I can eat more and have a better life. But this is very genetic. But as far as like what you say, yeah, I've had bikini competitors that they go so low in calories and they sit on the couch. They're so lethargic. And it's like, that's why a lot of times once you start after a show, you start eating a lot more. And then you're like, oh my God, I'm not gaining weight. You think it's because, oh, my thyroid was, down or my hormones weren't optimal. And it's not necessarily due to hormones. It's more due to like you start becoming more active throughout the day. And people underestimate how much NEAT can contribute. You have like a big dude like myself and I'm active all day long. That can easily be 3,000 extra calories a day. Mm. You know, if I'm a big dude like me being active the whole day versus sitting on the couch. So I wrote a really good article with my buddy James Krieger called Individual Differences, and then there was a subtitle like The Most Important Aspect of Science That you're Probably Not Familiar With or something like that. And it went through and talked about some people when they, and this is why I love studies that report all the data, the individual responses, because a lot of studies only report the mean. Then you look at the 30 participants, and like, look at this guy, and then look at this guy. This guy actually lost some muscle mass. So you can see these studies, and you can see that sometimes people do high-intensity interval training, and they just respond by eating more calories. That's me. I just get so hungry later in the day, I end up eating more. I don't just stick to macros. You can't just be like, Brett, eat 3,000 calories a day, and I stick to it like a champ. If I'm hungry before I'm going to sleep and my stomach's growling, I eat. So I will respond. You give me a hit and I just get hungry and I'll eat more. Some people do high intensity interval training and they get, it can be nausea related or just, it just blunts their appetite. They end up responding so well in terms of fat loss to HIIT training, high intensity interval training, not because of the calories they burned from the training, but because of the, more so due to their appetite suppressing effects. And this is very individual specific. Some people, weight training in general makes you more sympathetic, makes you more active throughout the day. It kind of raises your metabolism. But some things, like you do a lot of cardio, sometimes it can downregulate your metabolism it can downregulate your NEAT, I should say. Yeah. It can downregulate your activity levels to where it's a wash. So it's like, yeah, you went and did cardio and then you sat around because you were lethargic the rest of the day and it ends up being a wash. You could have just not done cardio and then been more active. And you would have lost the same amount of calories. So these are fascinating aspects of the nervous system's effects on physiology and how a lot of it's kind of pre-programmed and I just find that stuff so fascinating.
Yeah, like part of that, I just remember part of that rat study, they was adding that, once you take out the energy that you put into training and moving around and NEAT and all these sort of things, and you take out the energy that your metabolism has for stress, like handling life stress, I don't know, girlfriends, boyfriends, businesses,
heaps of partners,
all that sort of thing. And then the third thing is now whatever's left is the energy it can divert to, tissue growth, recovery, and that sort of thing. And so it's like if you have way too much of the training stress and way too much and you're moving around too much and then, your stress is too high at work or whatever, it doesn't leave you any energy left over to like repair tissue because it's like it's lower on the order. So like your body's less likely to do those things. And he was saying like how at one point when he had really low stress in his life, he did this certain program, Bulgarian training, and he got mad results. And then he had like 10 years later, he tried it again with like, two businesses and athletes and jobs, responsibilities, girlfriends, and like didn't have, his metabolism didn't have the energy left over to create the adaptations in that program, and so therefore he was left like injured and sore and like didn't get strong at all. So
that's why the studies always get such good results, because the studies are just on college students that are like earning $25 a day and yeah. have no stress.
Yeah.
Well, but I will add a caveat to that. Sometimes they deal with relationship stress, because I thought back to that. That made me think of when I was in college. I never had a girlfriend in high school. I was very picky, or I was unappealing. One of those
picky,
two.
Picky for glutes. Just looking at all their glutes. That's not good enough.
But my first girlfriend was when I was like 21 in college, and I remember I would Monday was International Bench Press Day, so I would do my pyramid sets. I do my set with 135, like 60 kgs, and then like 70 and 80, and I'd finish it like 100 kgs at around 225 ish, and I could always do like two or three reps. And my girlfriend broke up with me, and I remember that first month. I remember going in and trying my same sets, and I could not do it. I remember going down to where I couldn't hit 100 kgs for one rep. I would do 205 for like what would be my top set for a few reps. And it's like I lost 20 pounds. I lost like, around like 10 kgs of strength just from being dumped and being depressed and being sad. And it's like, you think about that. Who takes that into account? These training studies sometimes where you see like this guy lost strength, maybe he got broken up with. So that's why it's important.
That's so bad, because if you can't even bench 100 anymore, if you can't bench 100, there's no way you're getting a new girlfriend.
Yeah.
No.
So it's just self-perpetuating.
Imagine a study where they like start training them, and then they just get their wives to break up with them or some shit halfway through the study. They retest
the bench press.
That's a good study. That's a mad study. Nice.
You're gonna walk in on your wife hooking up with your best friend, and then see how that impacts.
Quickly go to the gym. So, Oh man, that's good.
Yeah, that's funny.
That's why studies need to have sufficient sample sizes to wash out those effects. Because if you had like 5 subjects in one group and 5 in another, that would severely affect the results. But if you have 20 in one group, 20 in another, then that should wash that out. You're going to have that happen. I remember one study I was involved with. I was testing 1RMs, and one of the girls was like, "Oh, I did ecstasy this weekend," and I'm like, what's protocol here? Like, do I report this? Do I pretend I didn't hear? Do I just be like, oh, I'm glad you were ecstatic this weekend? I don't know what to do here. So I'm like, okay, do you feel good? Okay, all right, I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that. So yeah, these things happen in the research.
Yeah, that's it's always going to be a part of it. So what have you read recently? I was going to ask, long way to get to my question finally, but what have you been reading recently that you feel like is really conflicting with some of the stuff that you did in your PhD? I know that in one podcast you mentioned that there was one study that found that maybe potentially hip thrust like didn't improve speed, and that's like one thing that you researched. I don't know if there was like maybe anything else like around that sort of stuff that's sort of conflicted since you finished your studying like 3 years ago.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So my study with hip thrust effects on acceleration and speed, my study was the first conducted, and I was blinded, by the way. I didn't collect the data or analyze it, but it showed that it improved acceleration better than front squats. Then 2 studies came out showing no effect on speed, and they gained a lot of strength. Now, it could be because they were fatigued and they didn't taper, or there could be a variety of reasons why. Maybe they just don't transfer well to speed. But then there's studies, it's funny, I'm peer reviewing one right now, and there's other studies showing high correlations between hip thrust strength and speed. And it's like, okay, so the correlation does not imply causation. And then there are researchers jumping on, you mentioned Andy Galpin earlier when you were talking to me on the, his student is doing a study on different types of, like hip thrusts where you have your feet elevated so the hamstrings get a better stretch. with lighter weight more explosively. It could be because it's such a slow contraction, you need to go faster. And this is why you can't just go by one study. You need multiple studies on a variety of populations with a variety of different training methods. That's the problem, though. Strength and conditioning research, you just don't have enough funding to have all these studies. So a lot of times we don't have the necessary information. So we have to make our decisions based on limited research and what seems logical, what seems to work for you in practice, your anecdotes, your personal experiences. And that's what we do, because we don't have these things. You know, cancer research gets funded, obesity research gets funded, not perform how to improve your acceleration, you know, your 40 meter dash, you know.
Yeah, the fools.
But you asked what other research is intriguing me right now. There was just a meta-analysis published by my buddies Brad Schoenfeld and James Krieger, and showing not much benefit to increase training frequencies above like twice a week. You know, there's not a lot of research showing if you train a muscle three times a week or more that it's better than training twice. And I've had great success with glutes, having girls train more frequently, like up to like four, five, six times a week. And if there's no benefit more than doing twice a week, then I'm wasting their time. So that's of great importance to me. However, no study has ever been conducted on glutes. So are the glutes unique? Mm. Also, there are different types of exercise. There's different training programs. Like if I did heavy walking lunges, I couldn't train frequently. I get so sore from them. But if I did band work, then I can train every day. Those don't get you sore. Those don't beat you down much. So maybe you can tinker with the program and bring about better results when you do. There's a lot of unanswered questions, basically.
Mm. Yeah, that is interesting. I definitely have noticed anecdotally that the bigger someone's training history is, so obviously the bigger base that they've built over the start of their life, the more they can hold adaptations or potentially create new adaptations off less training. That's just something I've seen. I think that's just because the skill element that's involved in weight training and compound movements and that sort of thing is so well refined that when they do go to put work in, they just get so much more out of it because they're able to just like drive their CNS harder or do the exercise better or create the adaptation faster. I think their body's just is more familiar with it, so they can get away with less training. Whereas newbies generally have to train quite a lot to kind of figure things out because, I mean, they really have no idea what they're doing most of the time.
Yeah, there's a lot of research on, maintenance. Like, it's very easy. You can do a couple sets a week and maintain most of your strength and most of your muscle as well. Building is hard. Maintaining is easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you I know there's research on this. I would have to look into it. But it makes sense what you just said, that the more experienced, the more ingrained your motor patterns and coordination are, you're not going to lose that quite as much, or it comes back so much quicker.
Mm. Yeah, we get a lot of, just to sort of sidetrack a bit on the performance side of glutes, we get a lot of people that come in to train with us, and they're not very good at squatting, and then the first thing that they've been told is like, oh, my glutes don't work. So this is like one thing that people give us a lot. And, you know, from the guests we've had on the podcast, most of them are like, well, look, if your glutes didn't work, you couldn't stand up, essentially. So, like, your glutes obviously working, and it's usually just how you're squatting. So, like, what are the main errors that you see where people that do squat training that, you know, say they come in with this sort of problem, or they feel like, you know, I squat every day, I deadlift every day, and I have tiny glutes. And
like, I can't feel my glutes.
Yeah. Well, the general feeling to me is that, you know, glute genetics is like a big factor as to why, like, you might not have a massive ass, even though you squat and deadlift every day. But maybe, I don't know, what have you seen from that sort of perspective?
Oh, that's such a good question. So first let me touch on my thoughts on the whole, like, your glutes don't activate. I've never told anyone that in all my years of personal training. I prefer to empower people, not focus on negatives. Second of all, I've never felt any glutes. I palpate everyone. Like, I'm a hands-on trainer. I've never felt glutes inactivate. Now, you will feel people who clinch and it becomes rock hard, and other people who have like a weak atrophied glutes that barely activate. They do activate. They're just not, you know, you want to be able to just from any position, you want to be able to do like the where you clinch down on your glutes and like can just hold that. You feel like you could crack a walnut
prison
between
guard
your cheeks.
Like when you're trying to hold in a fart.
Prison guard. Yeah.
Well, I don't think you contract that hard.
It's a big one. Depends on the circumstances.
Dude, yeah.
Prison guard is the hardest contraction possible. It's the hardest contraction.
That's your MBIC there. So anyway, you do see some people who, you know, they don't feel their glutes and all this. And I think, so here's my take on that. Physios and chiropractors and manual therapists, and they're well-intentioned, but a lot of times they do more harm than good. Then think about it. They make money based on people coming back to see them. So they don't know they're doing this. They're not like bad people, but they tell people, they label them. Because if you've got a label to it, no, shoot, that makes it serious. So now I got to come in. So like, let's say I get a client and they're just weak and deconditioned. Here's what you send that person to a physical therapist, and they're going to go, oh my God, I just evaluated you. I screened you, and you have excessive anterior pelvic tilt, and you have weak scapulae, and you have a weak core, and you have inactive glutes, and you have a leg length imbalance, and you have pelvic torsion, and you have, you know, this leg length discrepancy of, you know, 3 inches on one side or whatever. And then I get those people, and they all come to me, and they're like, I just want to let you know I've got all these issues going on. And I'm like, they'll go, I have got a leg length discrepancy. Oh, really? Lay down. Oh my God, your legs are perfectly symmetrical. Who told you that? And they're like, well, my chiropractor told me, but he did. And I go, I know he stood you up and he made you stand in some awkward position. He took an x-ray, but I'm telling you, you don't have a leg length discrepancy, okay? Well, my glutes don't activate. I'll go, okay, let me see. And I'll squeeze their glutes. I go, squeeze, try to contract your glutes. Oh, wow. They actually activate pretty well. And then they'll go, I have an excessive anterior pelvic tilt. And I go, I can't detect any pelvic. I think you look normal to me. Now, I don't have a goniometer or anything. I'm not going to measure you, but you look normal to me. But I actually wish I had anterior pelvic tilt, because sprinters do, and they're the fastest, most powerful people on earth. So they quickly realize they're not going to be able to say anything to me. I won't go. I won't let them have the crutches. Mm. I will not give them crutches. And they just stop. They don't tell me anything. And if they ever say, like, oh, I don't feel my glutes or something, I'll say, it's okay. You don't have to feel your glutes. I built good glutes, never focusing on this in the mind-muscle connection. Now I do, but, like, I used to just focus on progressive overload and making the movement look right, and my glutes developed. So I always just give them – I think about this. I am a strength and conditioning coach. I am trying to strengthen people's minds, bodies, and spirits. I will not do that by drawing attention to their quote-unquote dysfunction, whatever the hell that is. I won't do that by drawing attention to their weaknesses. I need to build them up mentally and physically, and I'm going to do so by focusing on the strength. So I never tell people they have inactive glutes or weak or a glute imbalance or anything. If you do see glute imbalances all the time, I tell them that's normal. Why would your glutes be perfectly symmetrical? You jumped off your left leg your whole life, or you kicked with your right leg, jumped off your left, stood, preferred this side for balance and things like that. Of course you're going to be a little bit imbalanced, but let's try to narrow the gap a little bit. So let's have you do some of this, you know, before your workout or something. Because you don't want to shy away from educating people, but you want to tell them this is a normal variance, that you're not weird. Mm. And you will become very strong. You will become fit. Because when you tell people stuff, they can get nocebo effects. If I sat there and went, oh my God, you have small glutes. Do you have back pain? Does your back hurt? That can plant seeds in their head, and they can manifest back pain because they think – they should experience back pain because they have weak glutes. So I don't ever say anything like that. I build people up. So I don't like the whole trend, but okay, moving on, you said when people – you talked about genetics. I agree. Genetics is so much of it. It's like 60% of it is just your glute genetics. And one study showed out of like 100 people's glutes – these are normal people, not lifters – one guy had 484% bigger glutes than another guy. It's like, yeah, almost five times as much glute mass. It was like 984 cubic centimeters of gluteal muscle volume versus like 224 or something crazy like that. It was like, or no, 198. It was 198 versus, I have a slide on it in my seminars, for my seminars. And this is just, you see this in your everyday population. You'll see people walking around. One person has amazing glutes, other people. So the problem is, that person who has amazing glutes, all they had to do was a few sets of squats and their butt looks amazing. So they give the stupidest advice to people who don't have good glute genetics. They're like, just squat, don't do anything else. And that is such bad, piss poor advice. And I get those people who've been told that. They start my programs and they transform very rapidly. So it's a ironic thing there that the people who have the least experience with it are the people who are getting consulted and looked up to for advice. We're really the world's glute expert is me. I didn't have glutes. I had to learn everything about them. That's why I became the expert. I had none. My back went right into my legs. I had to learn everything about it.
That looks so weird.
And you can look at some of the experts out there with these amazing butts and look at their programs, and some of them are just terrible. So, but it's always going to be like the biggest dude in the gym, the biggest personal trainer in the gym has the most business, and that's just the way our industry is. You're very lucky if you have good genetics for looking good.
Is there any like glute strengthening exercise that you find is like most correlated to squat strength? Because recently there's been a bit of a kick in the sort of CrossFit world and performance strength side of things, like on our end, that people are trying to get as strong as possible without squatting with a barbell, but to get a stronger barbell squat. And, you know, sometimes I feel like people are wasting their time with certain things, and then other times I'm not really sure. So I was just wondering if, like, from your experience, are there like certain exercises which you're like, man, like these things I can like confidently say with most people are definitely improving barbell squatting strength?
Okay, so in that scenario, if just based on all of my experiences and knowledge, I would, if you're looking at like an ass to grass high bar squat,
yeah,
then I would say something single leg that has you drop that deep, like. I want to say a high step up, but you can use a lot of momentum. So if you did like a strict high step up where your leg angle, your hip joint angle, and your posture was very similar to how it looked on two legs, because leg strength is so important for squatting. People think it's all posterior chain. The quads are so important for that. So a single leg movement where you go deep. So you don't go deep in a Bulgarian split squat. You only go around parallel. So maybe like a deficit Bulgarian split squat or a deficit reverse lunge or a high step up or a B stance squat or a pistol squat or something like that, where you're going rock bottom like that. I would say that would be most highly correlated, because a deadlift is not very correlated. Two different lifts. Deadlift is a hip hinge with higher hips, more hamstring. A hip thrust. Now, ironically, there's like two studies now. This one study showed that just with 8 weeks of hip thrusting alone, it transferred. They built their hip thrust strength up 35%, but their squat strength went up 31% without even squatting. So the hip thrust is a good builder for newbies of squat strength, but I don't think it would be the most correlated because it's such a different movement pattern. So out of all the different exercises, I would just say it's going to be a single leg movement that looks like a deep squat.
Mm. Have you played around with learning the front of the body and how that changes with the glutes? Because I know you've mentioned, you know, with a squat, it's not hard at the top, right? Like the top of the movement, the glutes aren't working very hard. They're working at the bottom of the movement. We've been playing around with like sandbag squats and like sandbag single leg work. And I have found that because the weight is pulling me forward, so it's like pulling me into hip flexion, because if the weight like pulled me, like my back would go over. It's much harder at the top of the movement. And I feel my glutes work to like open up my hips way harder.
So you're saying like front position, rack position, goblet squat?
Yeah,
like
a bit
that.
More. It's more with the sandbag because the weight's way out in front. So it's really pulling you forward.
Okay. So with that scenario, here's what people don't understand. Because a lot of times you'll see people say, well, the more upright your posture, the more quad, and the more you lean, the more hip. And that's not true. So like when you have the load in front of the body and in the situation of a goblet squat or like a sandbag squat or things like that, what that does is, let me see, this is easy to show on paper and or like on a whiteboard, but harder to explain. What it does is if you were to estimate if you were to draw like a free body diagram and try to estimate the joint torques, what you do is you go from the side view, like picture a squatter from the side view at the bottom of a squat. Now, if he's more upright, it makes you more upright, but you end up having similar joint moments even compared to when you're leaning, because the distance from the center of mass, the distance ends up being similar. So you actually, and so the studies show, actually it's ironic that you asked this, because just last week a study was published ahead of print in the JSCR that showed higher glute activation from the front squat compared to the back squat. My research did not show that. I published a similar study for my PhD on 13 trained women. It didn't show that. So that's where I'm like, huh. But at least it goes to show you that you don't have to lean to get the glute activation. And that's why it's also important to have multiple studies and keep an open mind. Oh, let me tell you, once you think you know something, you get thrown for a curveball.
Yeah. Well, it's good that...
Real quick, this is an important thing to mention. I love having my EMG instrument because I use it on clients. Now, I have one subject, one client. She was like my star client back in the day. Her name's Sammy. I can have her do... Now, she could squat 100 kgs for like 3 reps. She was so strong. I could have her do like a 205 pound back squat, and I could have her do a 50 pound goblet squat. So what does that come to in kgs? That's like 22 kgs or whatever. Like a 50 pound goblet squat, she got more glute activation with a 50 pound goblet squat than she did a 205 pound back squat. That's not everyone, that's her. Some people just get so much more glute activation when the load is just centered right there in front of them. Some people get way higher glute activation with Zurchers than they do, you know, back squats. Some people get that same subject, Sammy, she got way higher glute activation when she deadlifted a heavy kettlebell compared to a heavy barbell. Something about that weight being centered right there instead of out in front or behind her just made her glutes turn on way more. So that's why this reoccurring theme throughout this podcast is individual differences. You know, I work with clients. These are case studies. I deal in case studies, and I'm always trying to find the best methods per individual. And any person who makes broad black and white statements, this is the best for everyone, this is how everyone should be performing this lift, they don't get it. They're full of crap. They don't have the experience. They wouldn't be making stupid comments like that.
And so on that same merit, is back pain that people experience in deadlifting and squatting potentially due to like low glute activation or not using or having weak sort of single leg strength? Or do you find that, yeah, it's going to be case by case? It could be that they got poor form, or that this person, you know, doesn't brace properly, or...
It's... So like you can look at it, the danger of an exercise is directly correlated with its popularity and like its temptation to set a PR. Think about it. You ever hurt yourself on seated rows? Like,
no.
You ever hurt yourself on, you know, like an exercise that people don't care about because it's like you don't care so much. The things you want to set a PR on are the squats, deadlifts. Those are the coolest two lifts to PR on.
Mm.
So you're not as objective. You're not as like, if you were going to go do, you know, like lateral raises and your shoulder was hurting, you'd just stop doing them. But you don't start squatting, you'd be like, these aren't good for me today. If your shoulder was clicking, you'd be like, shoot, I'm going to set the dumbbells down. You'll do that with squatting and you're like, I don't feel good. And you'll just lie to yourself and be like, I'm going to push through it. You'll also force yourself to like, I can't tell you how many times I've rounded atrociously in a deadlift to get a new PR, and sometimes you get away with it and you're like, oh man, I pulled a fast one there, I probably should have hurt myself, but I got away with it. But it's yes, squats and deadlifts are very dangerous lifts because you're loading the spine, and you're going to be a little bit stronger in deadlifting in flexion usually. And with squats, you can go deep. You go too deep for your hip anatomy, and you're going to pull yourself into butt wink. You know, for deadlifts, usually the acute injuries are flexion related, but you can also get hyperextension related pain. That's more of a chronic thing, where you're just overarching for too long, too much volume, too many week after week after week. But anyway, I don't think it's as correlated to glute strength as people think. But on the other hand, I get so many emails from people saying, Brett, I started doing hip thrusts and your band work and my back pain went away. So it's like, on the one hand, I can tell you if I posted on like Instagram right now and said, hey guys, just curious, how many of you, your backs felt better once you started doing all this glute stuff I recommend? I'd probably get 80%. I'd probably get like 2,000 comments on there from people saying, yes, mine did. So I do. And that's where when the scientists are like the pain scientists act like there's no biomechanical rationale. It's like, you guys have never been in the weight room. Shut up and listen to us strength coaches. We're not as dumb as you think. Mm. But on the other hand, a lot of it isn't due to glute strength. It's due to bad mechanics and bad and poor program design. You mentioned squatting every day. Like, that's being greedy, you know? It's greedy. It's like I'm trying to reap all my gains very rapidly and see if I can get away with it. You know, I can't tell you how many people never had any knee pain from squatting until they start doing DUP. Mm. You know, you can get your back won't hurt if you deadlift heavy one day a week. Now you start trying to pull heavy twice a week. You know, it's just greed. It's greed. It's program design that doesn't suit your body well and bad mechanics. But glute strength can't help.
Mm. It's CrossFit. So I thought we'd ask sort of one question before we get into the sort of final four questions. And it can be a little bit controversial. I only say that because last time I asked this question in a room of so-called experts, I suppose, and I happened to get a huge roasting in front of an entire crowd at a festival we attended in Melbourne, Raf. And I was saying that I don't know, and this would be interesting for you because you come from the science side of things and the, you know, reducing pain and improving performance and health and longevity, but you also help bodybuilders. People that want to compete in the show. How healthy do you think competing is for, like, competing in bodybuilding is?
Or figure
for,
or anything.
Yeah, for an individual. And then as an industry as the whole, because, you know, the industry got, you know, people got into gyms because of Arnold. Let's be real. Like, pumping iron was a huge movement that set off a massive chain of events. But their focus was on doing whatever it takes to look as good as possible, really. I mean, there wasn't like, hey, you know, like, we're going to, you know, make sure we eat enough vegetables to be healthy because, you know, we want to feel good and spend time with our kids. It's like, no, okay, train like a savage, eat as many meat patties as possible to look like Arnold. That was sort of the reality. So do you think, yeah, for the individual, is bodybuilding shows good? And then do you think as a whole for the industry, like, are bodybuilding shows a good thing? And are they good goals for people to have?
I mean, it's so coincidental that you asked this question because yesterday I was in a weird funk the whole day because I am now working with probably, you know, well over 100 bikini competitors. And it actually got to me yesterday that I had a few come in and talk to me after the session. And I'm like, it's an ugly world. I don't think it's healthy. It's so, you should care about your total health and wellness. You have a life, you have a social life, you have friends, you have there's so much deeper things in this world that, yes, your physique is cool to care about your physique, but if you care about it so much to the point where you're obsessed about it and you're so vain that that's all you ever think about, it's just not healthy. It's not good. We want people that are deep, not these shallow surface level people that would do anything their spouse will leave them because they're going crazy and they don't care. You're so tunnel. You have such tunnel vision that all you care about is your physique in this show. And you obsess about it all day long. And I see the worst scenarios. It is an ugly world. Sometimes I go, I don't want to be involved in it because they're not, a lot of these girls aren't healthy because they yo-yo so bad. And a lot of the coaches are so bad out there. They're given the most unhealthy, unsafe practices. It's like get fat as hell off season and bulk like crazy. And then I'm going to diet you down so aggressively. I'm going to give you 900 calories a day and 2 hours of cardio. And then they get crazy to come, you know, especially women, because they already have more estrogen and different and cycles and things like that. And then they lose their periods and they it just can get, some women get crazy. I've seen it happen where some of my former clients won't compete anymore because the effect it has on them. And there's a better way. And this is why it's hard for me, because I go, there's such a better way. It's not that hard. Just don't bulk and cut. Just look good year round. Bulk up 10%, 12%. Cut down. Stay fit year round. Don't be obsessed. Have a good attitude about it. Go in there not being competitive and saying, I'm going to look the best I can look for me, and I'm going to get some cool pictures out of it. And no matter what I place, I'm going to shake the winner's hand and be happy. Then it's a good thing. And there are some people who have that attitude and who are more deep and more well-rounded, and then there are others that just get so sucked in, and it's so tragic. So on the whole, I think it is it does a net negative for people's health because it's a slippery slope and they get sucked in. But it doesn't have to. It does not have to. You can. There are competitors that are very healthy and have good mindsets and carry a job, and you know, their spouses and parents and good family members, and they're have it in proper perspective. It doesn't consume them, but it can. It's such an addicting. It sucks people in and chews them up and spits them out, and then you get these girls that they're spending more than they generate. They're living off their husband's salary, and they're so obsessed. Most of the girls end up getting a boob job. No judgment there, but you get so lean, you have nothing there. They'll get a boob job. They're getting all this cosmetic surgeries. They're spending a fortune on their. They have a nutrition coach, a training coach. Me, they have a posing coach. They're buying these expensive suits. They're traveling all around. They're paying the cost to compete in these shows. They're paying for travel, hotel, airport, meals, meal prep, supplements, you end up looking at how much they're making versus how much they're spending, and they're spending more than they're making. It's not a career. This is a vanity thing. It's like I don't know. I just what's in it? What's in it? So say you win first place. What do you make from that? Now you could say, well, you win sponsors and it comes back to positively impact you with social media and all these things. But at the end of the day, I wish more of them had a better overall healthier outlook and weren't so aggressive in their approach. They were more moderate. Moderate is healthier. It's, you don't have to be so extreme with your methods. And that's what I see it from all angles, and it's negative for a lot of people. Probably the majority of people, it's a bad thing. They shouldn't compete. Competing changes them for the worse, and it takes them a lot of years to get out of it.
Man, that was good. I think I appreciate you sharing that with the audience. I think the whole world needs to hear that. I think there should be like a. If you decide you're doing a contest, it's like you get Instagram banned or something. So like you can't look at it to self-shame yourself every day, because that's all people do, man. They look at the people that are at the top of their sport, you know, who have, you know, dieted down, say, for, you know, obviously who have great genetics and then have dieted down for a show. And then, you know, they're a professional. So, you know, they do 14 different photo shoots and they potentially have thousands of photos, which is plenty of content for the next 5 years. They can post it at any time, and you know, and they even say, they're like, oh, this was me like 12 weeks out, or like, this was me like post show or whatever. So you know, and they're telling you that this is me, this is not me right now, and you still don't care and want to look like that, even though you know that they can only look like that for maybe 2 or 3 weeks out of the year. And so you just constantly, and then you go in the mirror and you look at yourself and you're like, yep, I knew it. I look like shit. Or you're sitting down, you're hunched over and you're looking at your fat and you're just like, I'm a piece of shit. And it's just like this negative cycle. It's just so shit, yeah, for people. I don't know why they do it.
There's so much more to it than that. Are you helping people? Are you a good family member? Are you a good friend? Are you diverse? Do you spend all your time scrolling through Instagram looking at pictures? You actually try and learn and read, and there's so much knowledge out there. There's so much science. The world is a fascinating place. There's so much more to life than this, and some people just get so consumed, and then they look at themselves and it actually makes them, they actually feel horrible round the clock because they're so competitive. They follow all these people and they see the way they look and it makes them feel bad about themselves. And it's just and you have the dysmorphia and then you also have the eating disorders and the go with it. And it's just, yeah, I want more for people. I want them to be deeper. I want them to live a more fruitful, rich life. And it's hard if you've worked with people who are sucked in. They need I'm not equipped. I'm a strength coach. I try, but I'm not a counselor. I'm not a therapist. I don't know the exact right words to say. They need help, though. You know, they need help because they can be happier. And there's more to this life than that.
It's funny because they're like looking at, it'd be like amateur basketball players looking at LeBron James. And they, when they look at LeBron James' highlights on the NBA highlights reel on Instagram, they're like, yeah, it's fucking hectic, but it's like, that's LeBron James.
Yeah, and
but
they enjoy it.
Yeah.
They're not like, oh, this, yep. I hate myself.
Yep. But if like, you know, figure competitor amateur looks at figure competitor super pro 4-time Mrs. Olympia, they still for some reason are like, oh, how can I, like, I can still get there. Like, I'm not working hard enough. I'm a piece of shit or whatever. Reality is, yeah, this person is the top of the genetic pyramid, yeah, for that. And they're trying as hard as you, but fortunately, they just have better genetics. So, like, with the same effort, if not less effort, they look 30 times better than you. And that's kind of the name of the game. Yeah,
that's exactly what I tell my girls. Like, you think that you need to train harder. I've trained the creme de la creme. I've trained several Miss Bikini Olympia winners for bikini. But I've trained the nicest glutes in the world. And don't train harder than a lot of my clients that just have lackluster glute development. It's most of it's genetics, and I wish more people understood that.
Yeah, we see people in like CrossFit class that don't train as hard as people that are really, really good at it all the time. So people in the CrossFit class, they train harder. And people that are like going to regionals and all that stuff. Yep. And it's just like, look, I don't know what to tell you. They played sports growing up. You didn't.
Yeah.
It's over.
Yeah. It's tough. It's a hard pill to swallow. But you're right. People just need to be more fruitful. They need other things. They need to go deeper and understand there's more to it than the surface level stuff.
I have good outlook because, I mean, I could sit there and go, God, I mean, think about this. I'm Brett Contreras. I'm the glute guy. I've got, 308,000 followers on Instagram. I'm pretty popular. I'm well-educated. I've got a good life. I've got a good disposition. I'm a decent-looking guy. I'm not a supermodel-looking guy, but I'm not ugly.
No mama's a project.
I could sit there and go, God, look at The Rock. The Rock has 100 million followers, and he's so jacked, and why can't I be that muscular and fit and wealthy and have his money and have his opportunities, and I could make myself depressed thinking about that. Or I could go, man, I'm so lucky. I'm tall. I look like I'm smart enough to get a PhD. I'm smart enough to have found my passion, so it's not hard work. Like I live in San Diego, right along the beach. I've got a good freaking life. You know, I could make myself miserable or I could put things into proper perspective. And that's what I always tell these people. I'm like, you're comparing yourself to the creme de la creme. Why don't you compare yourself to your high school classmates? You know, like that's what I have to do that with my physique. Cause I could sit there and go to all these Greek gods that I follow on Instagram that look like they're computer generated. If I compared myself to them, I'd be depressed all day long. I choose to compare myself to my high school athlete jock friends, and I'm like, I look better than all of them now, you know?
Nice.
I'm 41. I'm 41 years old. I still look pretty good.
Holy shit. 41. Jesus Christ. Brett, you look like, I reckon you look about 31, 32. It's the eyebrow piercing as well. Like, it's just the, makes you look way younger.
Thank you.
All right, cool. Well, we'll get into the final questions. That was sort of a good place to end that. So you don't have to answer these quickly. In fact, we encourage you to take your time with them. But first question is the interview question. If you could sit down with anyone and you know, they would answer anything that you ask them openly and honestly, and you had as much time as you needed, who would you choose to sit down and interview that's alive today?
Oh, that's alive today. Okay. God, you even sent me these questions. I know.
Doesn't help. It never will help.
I thought you were a researcher.
It was alive today. Yeah. I was gonna say Mel Sif. You know, he died though. He wrote the book Super Training, and I just had the utmost respect for him.
Okay.
And my answer was I didn't see. I skipped that.
That's pretty good
part,
though, because he only just died. We more wanted to just get rid of like Leonardo da Vinci and shit, like Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That's more what we're thinking.
So Mel Sif, a lot of the listeners should know that are listening to this should know about Mel Sif. He wrote the book Super Training with Yuri Verkhoshansky. A lot of my colleagues got to spend time with Mel. So he was I know he was a professor in like Africa. He was also like an Olympic weightlifting coach, but he was a student of sports science, and Super Training to this day is such an amazing resource. And he moved to Denver, Colorado, and he would tell people there were Yahoo Super forums or something, and he was like very active. So he had a lot of the weight training community, you know, who followed him, and he was kind of the ringleader. And he would tell people, if you come through my city, you need to stop by and spend the night. So all these colleagues of mine actually spent the night in his place. They'd stay in his basement in a sleeping bag, and you'd be in his basement with copies of like his whole library was in there. And then you'd see like the original drawings for the Super Training book, like sketches and stuff in there. It just seems so surreal. And he'd wake you up at like 4 a.m. His wife would have breakfast for you, and he'd teach you Olympic lifts the whole day. So you'd like go 3 hours going over like snatch and snatch variations, and then like take a break and eat, and then go over squats. And who's that unselfish? He'd made no money off that. So he's just such a remarkable human being. But I would love to get his take on all the controversial things that are going on now. all the big controversies. You know, I would love to be. I like to think if he was still around, he and I would be close friends, and I'd call him up and rant and rave, and he'd be, you know, I'd get him to weigh in on these different topics. So I'd love to hear his thoughts on sprinting forces, on vertical versus horizontal, on spinal flexion. Is it the devil or is it no big deal? Things like related to program design and things like that. I just love to hear his take on these things. So that was my answer to that, but he's deceased.
That's good.
What was he? Like, what nationality was he?
Was he like Eastern Europe?
Russian?
I think I know he was a professor in South Africa, a white guy. I don't know. I don't know what if he was European or South African, but just that, you know, it's funny. There's none of them left anymore. The good sports scientists from back in the day. Mm. Vladimir Zatsiorsky is still alive, but he doesn't. Like it's interesting. I was researching him. I reached out to him like several years ago and emailed him and got him to chime in on something to do with hip thrusts, on calculating joint torques. And he was the only guy who admitted, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but it's complicated. All these other guys I emailed, all these top guys in the field pretended to know. And it took me a while to realize they don't know how to calculate joint torques, how to estimate joint torques in a hip thrust. It's not like a squat or a deadlift where it's standing. You've got your back on the bench and your feet on the ground. Andrew Vygotsky figured out how to estimate it. You've got two different force vectors, and you have to calculate the distance from those force vectors in meters and then average them together. It's actually fascinating. I told you he's so smart. But anyway, he kind of like Zatsiorsky over the years shifted more towards hand, fine motor, like hand biomechanics. That's what he was publishing on, and he wrote the book, The Science and Practice of Strength Training. And these are classics for these new up-and-comers that have not read these texts. However, I also say you shouldn't worship these old Russian coaches because they didn't have as much. We have a lot of evidence at our disposal now that they did not have. And but they were ahead of their years. They were so advanced. But there was a bunch of them. Verkhoshansky, Zatsiorsky, Sif. And most of them are gone now. They're deceased. So I have a lot of respect for these guys.
Hmm. Yeah, it's funny. Their context and the studies that they did is so interesting as well.
They also had a lot of steroids at their disposal we don't have these days.
No, we got that. We got that. They just have it funded by the government. That's all. That's the big difference. Endorsed by the government. So second question that we have is Brett, what is something that you do every single day as like a part of a routine that you feel like is integral to the success of your day?
So I this is such a good question. I keep repeating that. So good job, guys. Remember, I'm a former high school math teacher. So the way I look at social media is, did I teach somebody something today? Did I teach my followers today something today? So some days I don't post on Instagram. It bothers me. I want to be teaching people. If I post something that's just promoting a service of mine, I'm not teaching them. So if you can have that attitude, like, what can I teach? Can I teach somebody something every day, 365 days a year? You have a leg up on your competition. The other thing is helping people helps you because it makes you feel better about yourself. I've done a lot of research on happiness. You get more out of helping others than you do yourself sometimes. There's research showing if you spend some money on someone else rather than yourself, you feel better. So it's just good for good vibes, you know. So just go about your to the listeners out there, quit focusing on just try to focus on what can I do to teach somebody something today? What can I teach them? And you'll do well.
Nice, that's good. I think more people definitely needed to hear that. And yeah, it's good. I think that more educational content on Instagram is only better because it's like 1% of the content that's out there. So I always do a cleanup through my Instagram. I'm like, you haven't given me anything in a while, like unfollow. It's just pictures of your body, unfollow. Like it's got to be something useful in there. Otherwise, I'm just wasting my time.
And also, what's the best media for that? Is this information best taught in an infographic, in a video, what's the best format for it? Should I write a blog post and link to it? Should I film a longer YouTube video and link to it? That's another decision you have to make.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Instagram's the best place to reach people, but not the best place to teach people. And you're right. I would much rather pull people or attract them on Instagram as like the flashing lights, but then pull them into the good stuff, you know, on the YouTube or on podcasts or on blogs where you have more opportunity to speak to them for a while and let your ideas sink in. Cool. So, but people just want information fast, unfortunately. So, third question is, what is something recently that you've changed your mind on, Brett, that for a while was a strong-held belief of yours?
So I have this joke with my buddy Brad Schoenfeld that we're like 50-50 with our hypotheses. Like when we go into studies, we'll be pretty confident. And half the time we're shown to be wrong with the data. So this happens a lot. And I can think back to things I did. And it's funny. You can be a good trainer and get good results and be just full of bro science. You know, think about, I got great results 15 years ago. And I tell everyone, you want big arms? Squat and deadlift, because this is going to cause you to release a bunch of testosterone and growth hormone that's just going to be coursing through your veins, and it's going to attach to the androgen receptors on every cell, and you're going to get big everywhere. And that's not true. Stu Phillips has debunked that. It's just not true. You can do squats and deads. Yes, you get a surge of you get a hormonal release, and it does not affect your biceps.
I also proved that as well. I squat and deadlifted for years. Arms are still small.
Yeah. You dispel that notion. So, no, I'm just kidding. but there's a lot of those. The stoke the fire myth. You got to eat 6 times a day to stoke the fire and keep the metabolism to prevent going into starvation mode. There's so many of them. And hell, even now when I'm second guessing myself on is the training frequency, especially with glutes. Do they need to train? Because I used to tell people train glutes 5 days a week. I think I went overboard. I think maybe 3 is fine, you know. So you always got to be questioning yourself, though. You can't get too confident.
But then if you look even broader, it's like, well, isn't a week just like a invention that we made up as like humans in Western society? Like there's not actually any things as week. There's just sunrise, sunset till you die. And there's not even really a thing of age either. So it's like, well, if you think about our biology, then maybe it's just like, fuck, what were we doing? Like, what can I do? And then it just becomes...
No, I think they
like,
always had chest day.
Oh, they did. No, you're right. They always had bench press.
They always had chest day.
Yeah, cavemen on Mondays.
That's since the very beginning.
Yeah, they had 7 strokes, and on the 8th stroke, they would do chest again. Because they knew it was chest day. It wasn't called Monday, yeah. But then that becomes an even more interesting thing, right?
It could be twice every 6 days. We go by weeks and months, and it's arbitrary.
Yeah. Yeah, what if you looked at it as like every 100 days or like every 1,000 days? Like how often would you train every 1,000 days? That's crazy to think of. But like how is a week any more productive? It just kind of suits your lifestyle really. So I guess it's contextually it's the most relevant. But yeah, it's always an interesting thought experiment. So was there anything one specific thing or was it just a combination of all those things?
Yeah, I'm not doing a good job.
I was like, did I forget his answer or did he just not answer it?
Just answered like 9 different ones.
Yeah, I gave you 3, so.
I guess training frequency is probably the big one at the moment for you. Yeah. Yeah, cool. Okay, and then our final 2 questions is, Brett, what is one of your favorite quotes and a favorite book of yours, maybe that you've read recently or that you're reading at the moment?
So a favorite book of mine, and it's funny, I read this in my, like when I was like 21, I think. So it's been 20 years. and it's called The Fountainhead. It's by Ayn Rand. She also wrote Atlas Shrugged. And now she's kind of crazy. She had her own like branch of philosophy called objectivism. And I never got into that. I never understood why people were so psychotic about it. But this book, Fountainhead, kind of changed my life, and I'll explain why. So in the book, and I haven't read it in so long, there were these two architects, and it kind of followed their stories. And they, one of them got classically trained, went to the best college, and went to the best firm, and got hired at the best, you know, and he rose up, and he was like the best of the best. He was the best architect. And the other guy went to the same school and then dropped out because he thought the assignments were silly. They weren't benefiting him. And he went and worked for like, he apprenticed for like his favorite guy, who wasn't the most popular architect out there, but he respected him the most. And then he like took a job for like $1, and he didn't do things for the money. He did it for the experiment, the experience and the love of the craft. And in the end of the book, he ended up being like more popular than the other guy and more successful. And I probably butchered the hell out of that. Like I said, it's been 20 years, but it's always, so I listen to all these people, and I make a good living now, okay? But I don't focus on money. I'm not like, I got to charge the most I can possibly make. I have helped more people for free than anyone on this freaking planet, any coach on this planet. I can't even tell you how many people. Like, my glute lab is opening up today. I haven't charged anyone. I've been waiting on permits and things like that. I haven't charged anyone. I've trained people for 2 straight months and never charged them a dime. Because I just love helping people and I'm making a good life. So we don't have to, number one, you don't have to just, you're not going to be your happiest by just exploiting everyone and making them, extracting the most, generate the most possible revenue you can with your limited, you know, skill set. There's more to life than that. So at my old gym lifts, I charge $25 a session for group training. So I'm like, hell, if I get 4 people in there, I make $100 an hour. That's fine with me. You know, and if I only have 1 person in there, this guy gets $25 a session. I came from being a teacher. I never needed that much. And then all my products I've always made, people go, oh, my God, you could be charging 3 times that much. But guess what? I've helped so many people. And look at how I've changed the world. You know, I have people from all over the world doing my stuff. So and that gives me intrinsic reward and satisfaction that's beyond measure. Hmm. So, I remember reading another book. I think it's advice because I was at one point in time, I was thinking about becoming a lawyer. And I read this piece of advice that said, you want to become a good lawyer, right out of law school, take a job as a public defender. They'll throw so many cases at you in 3 years, you'll get more experience than you would in 2 decades somewhere else. And then you'll have all that knowledge and you'll be amazing at what you do. Now, that's the attitude I always had. If I charge less, I can train more people, get more people in the doors. And then I get so much more expertise because I can sit there and go, you know, this person squats best when they take a wide stance. This person, when they get a narrow stance. This person, if I elevate their heels, it fixes everything. This person needs to keep vertical shins and sit back. This guy likes goblet placement. This guy likes Zercher. This guy likes high bar. Low bar, front, this guy I can't go deep with, I go slightly above parallel, this person, you know, not just with squats, with every exercise and every program. There's a program design and a set of exercises that best suit this individual, and it changes over time. And how the hell are you going to become an expert charging $300 a session and training two people a day, you know, compared to if you're working with tons of people? So don't just do things to maximize your profit. Do things to profit, to gain expertise, and to help people. And it's kind of like where those three few things merge that are the sweet spot for making you the best you can possibly be and ultimately the happiest.
Nice. Don't need to read the book now.
Fountainhead. That was the craziest answer I've ever got to favorite book.
Usually they're just like Fountainhead. It's a good one.
Yeah, that was amazing. Well done, Brett. Fantastic.
You guys set me up to look good. So you guys asked some great questions. This was. I'm so glad I did this. Thank you.
No, we definitely appreciate you being on. And I know it's like a long term follower of yours. It's been really cool to get an opportunity to chat with someone like you. And we'd love to get more scientists on the podcast in the future, and we'll actually be out in California later this year, so we'd love to get your digits and meet up and go to the glute lab.
You have to
wait till you see Raph's glutes.
Where you say, oh shit, Brett, our recorder wasn't recording.
Oh yeah, fuck that. That would be a disaster.
Would come, you gotta come visit, come out to San Diego. It's such good weather. It's a good city, so I hope you do come. And if you ever need recommendations for good scientists, hit me up.
Yeah, we will. We will. I think we went as far as Encinitas last time. So not all the way into the heart, but pretty close. So we'll definitely make it all the way down. Fantastic. Brent, where can people find you, and where can they follow you on Instagram, and or where do you want to send them?
I have a blog that's brettcontreras.com. If you can't spell my name, you could type in glute guy onto Google, and I think I come up. I think my blog will come up. But I don't blog much anymore, but that does have links to my social media. I'm most active on Instagram. I do send out a newsletter. I never spam people. It's just like, hey, here's what it's like once a month I send something out. Here's some cool stuff. Here's like the podcast I've done or any article I wrote or a notable social media post. But yeah, probably Instagram I'm most active on, especially I try to do my story and everything and give people a taste of my life. That's always fun. But yeah, on Instagram I'm at Brett Contreras one. Someone else took Brett Contreras, and there's one T in Brett, so this poor guy gets tagged all the time going, why do people tag me in all glute things related?
He's gonna buy the handle off him.
Do you have a program or like an example program for people that just do squats and deadlifts, like the normal stuff in the gym or CrossFit gym, and want to do like a bit more glute isolation work?
I had a blog post I wrote a long time ago that said CrossFit needs a glute wad. And it's because the people who have done that, just like, because you don't want to keep adding and adding if people are already overdoing things. But what I tell you, because a lot of CrossFitters have hyperextension related back pain and strong glutes in a flex position, but not in an end range position. They start doing some glute bridges and hip thrusts and lateral band work, and it cleans things up and it helps fix it solves their pain. They stop hyperextending so much, and it makes them more well-rounded athletes. So I highly recommend. And then people say, well, what can I do? Just do three sets of hip thrusts or back extensions where you really focus on the end range glute squeeze. I do rounded back extensions with feet flared out for more glute, which I have on like YouTube and things like that. But like, you don't have to add in that much. Just add in a few sets twice a week, and then maybe a couple sets of lateral things, like lateral band stuff, and that makes a big difference over time.
Mm. Yeah, awesome. All right, we'll make sure we'll find that and post it up for the listeners. All right, awesome. Fantastic. Brett, thanks so much for being on again, and we'll be sure to hit you up when for round two when we make it out to California this year.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Cool, Brett. Thanks for that, man.
Thanks so much, Brett. Have a good one, man.
You too.
Guys, what an amazing episode with Brent. Great, great information. Thank you so much, Brett, for coming on and sharing all that stuff. So guys, remember, you can go to beyondmacros.com/group and join us in the next few days to get set up for the nutrition coaching group style with Matt at Beyond Macros. Getting just the value of one-on-one. And then Raph, True Protein.
True Protein, Mind Muscle 10. You get 10% off.
And this week, you can get a free hat over $900. And next week, if you're listening to this a little bit late, it's 10% off all the protein flavors.
Amazing. Yep. So, go get it, trueprotein.com.au, beyondmacros.com, and we'll see you there. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themymuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.